Good morning and welcome to The Great Outdoors. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Mark Deutsch, reading from publications that bring the outdoors in and straight to you. Our first article today comes to us from the Nature Conservancy magazine and is titled Counting on Fish. New technology is revolutionizing how we track fish catches and yielding a treasure trove of data that is driving better management of fisheries. By author Melissa Gaskill. Centuries of fishing tradition weave through communities along the rugged Maine coastline. In the mid-coast village of Port Clyde, at the tip of St. George Peninsula, fourth-generation fisherman Randy Cushman has chased groundfish such as flounder, hake, sole, cod, and pollock for 45 years. 35 of them as captain and most on his 45-foot trawler, the Ella Christine. During that time, Cushman has seen the size and type of fish in these waters change, along with the rules about what he could catch. At the Portland Fish Exchange, where Cushman sells his catch, in 2016, the number of landings, or fish brought into port and sold, were roughly 12% of 2003 levels, a drop largely attributable to decreases of up to 90% between 2010 and 2016 in how much cod Gulf of Maine fisheries were allowed to pull in. Fisheries managers across the country set these catch limits in tune with the rise and fall of the number of fish in the sea. Estimates on how many of the world's fisheries are struggling vary in part because of a lack of data. But the data that does exist suggests that many fisheries are overfished or in decline. Balancing viable commercial fisheries with the health of specific species and the wider ocean ecosystem presents a growing challenge. It requires estimating how many fish are in the ocean and how many of the fishers can catch this year to have similar or better populations next year. Questions that are somewhere between wicked hard and impossible, says Chris McGuire, a marine policy expert who directs the Massachusetts Marine Program for the Nature Conservancy. Current methods oversimplify, he says, and basically result in a snapshot in time that can't account for all of the variables. So, researchers, managers, marine conservationists, and fishermen like Cushman have teamed up to find better ways to count fish in New England waters and beyond. While industry regulators have relied on human observers on boats to verify captains' reported catch, a growing wave of fisheries are floating the idea of using technology instead. Electronic monitoring, essentially video cameras on boats, may provide more accurate, cost-effective, and timely fish counts, making it possible to hook catch limits more closely to actual populations and improving the effectiveness of conservation restrictions. Everyone complains that what fishermen observe on the water doesn't match the science, McGuire says. But you have to have good information going into the models to get good science out. The hunt for data. To put it another way, you cannot manage what you cannot measure, says Mark Zimring, the director of a TNC program focused on Indo-Pacific tuna. And getting those measurements accurate is a challenge. Currently, U.S. fisheries rely largely on catch limits, with quotas based on estimates of the size of fish populations. Catch limits are only the latest fishery management tool in a long history of sometimes stormy negotiations between fishers and regulators. Throughout the 1800s and early 1900s, the fortunes of fishing communities and the health of marine ecosystems often followed the booms and crashes of fish populations. The changing equipment available to fishers, and the level of competition from abroad. In the 1970s, a landmark piece of marine legislation, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, established stronger U.S. jurisdiction over coastal waters, charging 8 regional fishery management councils with developing sustainable management plans based on science. The debates over how many fish were in the sea heated up. By 2011, all U.S. fisheries managers had set catch limits based on assessments of fish populations. Some had set the limits several years earlier. These assessments are based on data collected on trawl surveys conducted by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Marine Fisheries Services and reports from fishers. Fishers are required to report everything that comes over the rail of a boat, landings and discards, which are fish thrown overboard because they're the wrong species or outside legal limits. But that information is incomplete, and from fishers' perspectives, out of date by the time it's used. When fishers observe increases in stock, official data backing that up can take 2 or 3 years to reach managers, says Chris Brown, president of Seafood Harvesters of America and a fishing boat captain in Rhode Island. We don't have any opportunity to catch them while numbers are up. Then we're gifted the opportunity to increase pressure on a fishery right at the time it can't take it. We're always out of sync. Fishers and regulators needed a way to get in sync. But the common practice of using human monitors on boats not only brought its own problems, but also provided inadequate data in some regions. Experimenting with cameras on boats. By the mid-2000s, with video cameras increasingly common in a multitude of settings, a number of fisheries began to test using these cameras to provide information on catch and discards for population assessments. Fisheries program staff at TNC thought the idea showed promise and decided to help accelerate its implementation in the United States. In 2013, TNC partnered with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and EcoTrust Canada to install camera systems on 2 vessels and another 5 the following year, including Cushman's Ella Christine. The cameras collected video of an individual boat's catch and of each fish discarded back to the sea. Then a reviewer on land used a video to tally the total catch. The partners paid the cost of equipment and reviewing the footage. The 3-year pilot project showed that data generated by video reviewers analyzing footage was comparable to that from observers on the boats. The National Marine Fisheries Service approved a special permit for the 2016 season, allowing video monitoring as a replacement for at-sea monitoring on certain boats. And in 2017, McGuire reports, 17 vessels in Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island carried cameras. Every fishery has unique characteristics. So in 2014, TNC launched testing on the west coast of the United States, partnering with the Environmental Defense Fund and the California Groundfish Collective. That Fisheries Management Council requires every trip to have a human observer on board to verify discards as well as individuals on the shore checking the catch. Data from 6 vessels off the California coast also showed no significant difference between traditional logbook estimates and records from reviewing onboard camera videos. Fishers saw some other differences, though. They found that cameras were significantly cheaper and allowed them to fish when they and the weather were ready, rather than having to wait and pay for a human observer. Cameras also took up less boat space. California fisherman Jeff Betancourt was able to sleep in his own bunk again after surrendering it to an observer for 4 years. In April 2017, the Pacific Fishery Management Council recommended regulations to allow for electronic monitoring in the West Coast groundfish fishery by 2018 or 2019, depending on the gear involved. With the basic technology proven, TNC now hopes to improve it, says Kate Cower, TNC's California Groundfish Program Director. That includes tweaking the placement of cameras, developing algorithms to do some of the work of human reviewers, and testing video upload via satellite rather than on mailed-in hard drives. Outside the lab, TNC marine program managers are helping to inform policies for the use of electronic monitoring, as well as encouraging others to buy into the concept. But the bottom line is the accuracy of the data. Accurate, timely data on fish populations, size of catch and amount of bycatch, which are unintended species caught while trying to catch something else, will help managers set appropriate catch limits and guide use of other management and conservation tools, such as closures or gear modification. Better data, in short, supports better management. For example, before catch limits and 100% monitoring in California, the groundfish fishery had been declared a disaster, with many stocks considered depleted or overfished. But a lot of fishers didn't think it was that bad, TNC's McGuire says. Now we have some really good data and startling reports of rebuilding. Several fish stocks have grown faster than researchers thought biologically possible, he says. We don't hear fishermen complaining about bad assessments. It's an interesting lesson on the value of good data. It also includes fishers in the science and management process in a way not often done before, says Jeffrey Smith, TNC's Gulf of Maine Marine Program Director. It empowers fishermen to be a part of the process instead of a victim of it, he says, and the evidence of the potential of electronic monitoring to reduce costs without compromising data quality or integrity represents a game changer farther afield. TNC wants to apply these concepts in the Western and Central Pacific tuna fishery, which drops 1 billion hooks a year and has 2% human observer coverage. Cameras are being installed aboard 26 boats that fish in waters managed by the parties to the Nauru Agreement. The group's members are Micronesia, Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, Nauru, Palau, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and Tuvalu. Together, they control 70% of the area's tuna fishery. Data from the cameras can help guide the group's management decisions, such as capping bycatch, which accounts for as much as a third of what these vessels bring in, rather than restricting when and where boats can fish, says Mark Zimring. Once a boat hits the number of sharks allowed, for example, they are on the dock, Zimring says. That creates a powerful incentive for them to solve the problem, to not catch things we don't want them to catch. It partners us with fishers. A new tide. In June 2015, the highly migratory species fishery in the Atlantic became the first in the United States to officially transition to cameras as electronic monitors. Cameras are used in its management program for deepwater migratory fish, which includes tuna, swordfish, sharks, and billfish. California's ground fishery will likely be next, in 2018 and 2019. In the meantime, the Magnuson-Stevens Act, most recently renewed in 2006, is up for reauthorization. It may take longer for New England to make the switch. On the West Coast, fishers pay to have an observer on the boat each trip, making any cheaper option an appealing one. New England's fisheries requires observers on only about 15% of trips, says Smith. As a result, the cost effectiveness isn't as strong of an incentive there. Having cameras on board also makes some uneasy. More than one fisher has likened it to Big Brother. At the same time, in an industry that hinges on how many fish officials say there are in the sea, the prospect of getting better numbers and faster may persuade some fishers to consider cameras. For others, accountability offers incentive enough. I have nothing to hide and plenty to prove, Cushman says. When the science says one thing and fishermen see another, the camera keeps everyone honest. Author Melissa Gaskill is a freelance writer based in Austin, Texas. Her work has appeared in Mental Floss, Audubon, and Texas Highways. Our next article today comes to us from Virginia Wildlife Magazine and is titled Bring Me a Shrubbery by author Steve Living. Shrubs have been on my mind lately, perhaps a result of watching too much Monty Python in my youth. More so because the importance of this part of the habitat puzzle has been obvious over the last couple of weeks around my house. I have some mature native trees, including oaks, pine, black cherry, and American holly. These are important and provide food for many native insects, which are the main food for baby birds. I've been removing invasive shrubs like privet, nandina, and white mulberry, and planting native species like wax myrtle, silky dogwood, and arrowwood viburnum. I'm also letting other native species like winged sumac and devil's walking stick establish on their own. There are also some exotic species that are not invasive that I'm keeping around because they add some color and are large enough to provide important habitat benefits for wildlife while I wait for my native shrubs to get big enough to add habitat structure. Just how important are shrubs and small trees to nesting birds? Let's take a look at who's been nesting on my little half acre. We often think about nest boxes to help breeding birds. Well-designed and placed boxes can be a great resource in your yard, but are only used by a relatively small number of species. I have some camellia in my front and backyard. As evergreens, they provide good year-round cover. They are also a source of nectar and pollen for early or late season insects like the monarch butterflies that showed up last November. As much as I love monarchs, I mean, who doesn't? Even more exciting for me is that for at least 2 years in a row, I've had brown thrasher and gray catbirds nesting in these shrubs. These are species of greatest conservation need in Virginia, and they're breeding in my little slice of suburbia. Considering these non-native shrubs and trees as a productive part of a wildlife habitat may seem counterintuitive given how much we emphasize using native plants to help create wildlife habitat. This general priority still holds true. The more native plants you establish, the greater your habitat's ability to support biodiversity. In fact, research shows that native plant cover of at least 70% may be needed to support some bird species. The success that these birds had in my space is in due part to a significant and ever-increasing amount of native plants. You also need to work with what you have, and it may take some time for native plantings to catch up and provide the habitat values that mature shrubs and small trees provide. In the meantime, there's room for a few exotic, but not invasive, species to fill some roles in your habitat while you keep adding beautiful native species to your space. Learn more in DWR's Habitat at Home booklet. Find what plants are native to your region of Virginia and find where to purchase native plants by visiting plantvirginianatives.org. Author Stephen Living, the DWR Habitat Education Coordinator, is a biologist and naturalist with a lifelong love of wildlife and nature that began in the woods and streams of his childhood. Our next article today comes to us from Orion Magazine and is titled Bernardo's Corrido, a short story by Alberto Alvaro Rios. A car, not carelessly, but in following too literally the grammar of the street signs and making a turn that was a little too wide, hit Bernardo the dog. Their meeting made a small but unmistakable sound, and the car lurched afterward to a stop. It was an accident, but like all accidents, there was no taking it back. Everyone who was in the area stopped to see what had happened, and the driver of the car was distraught, not seeming quite able to work the car handle to open the door, and finally giving up in an enervated swoon back into the car seat. "I'm all right," the person was heard to say, after which all attention turned to the dog. The dog was flat on the ground, not dead, but on the ground. Everyone recognized Bernardo. "Thank God he's not dead," someone said. But that was all. Nobody was quite sure what to do next, and each hoped someone else would take charge. Bernardo was not bleeding, or did not seem to be, but his tongue was falling out of his mouth and hung far too low to the right. Bernardo's breathing was not fast, but should have been. A workman brought over an old towel and wrapped it around the dog, who did not seem to notice. It was a kind gesture and was all that the workman meant to do, but people crowded up behind him so that he could not now back away. "Call the doctor," he said, to nobody in particular. "Yes, call the doctor," said someone else. It made sense, or as much sense as anything else. Bernardo was a dog, of course, but surely a doctor could be counted on to know what to do. The new doctor in town, Dr. Bartholomew, surely he would know what to do next. Several people went hurrying in his direction. His office was not far, and he was brought back to the scene quickly. Everyone made way for the doctor, and the workman was finally able to step away. He simply pointed at the towel with which he had covered Bernardo. Dr. Bartholomew looked down, kneeled, and removed enough of the towel to say, "But it's a dog." "Yes," people said, "it's Bernardo." The doctor hesitated. He was new in town, and he understood the moment to be something beyond the dog. He was not a veterinarian, but he was not incapable of help either. There was nobody else, and he saw as much when he looked back at everyone. He threw his hands up in a decisive gesture and told nobody in particular to bring the dog into his office. "I'll look at him and do what can be done. Is there an owner?" he asked. Everyone simultaneously volunteered Miguel Torres's name and added that something must have happened, that Miguel Torres and this dog went everywhere together. "Well, go find Señor Torres. Now be careful when you lift this dog. We don't want to do any more damage." Through all of this, Bernardo listened patiently. He was in no mood to argue or to move. Lying down felt all right to him and was where he preferred to stay. When someone began to pick him up, he wished it were not so, but he had no particular energy to resist. Like the voices he was hearing, the feeling of being lifted seemed like an echo to him, something far away even though it was happening to him right then and there. Still, and how curious, thought Bernardo, it all felt black. When curiosity presented itself to him, Bernardo always stopped and his tail was a barometer of his interest. He stopped wagging and concentrated. Right now, his tail was not wagging, which was good. That was right. Something was happening. In this blackness and in the curious moment, then, where Bernardo should have been standing and looking into what was what, he instead fell asleep. Bernardo. It was such an elegant name. Names for dogs rarely got so much attention, and even when they did, the quicker "get out of here" and even no name at all just had a hard hand to the back or a kick to the tail or the stomach. These were the real names that worked, if a dog knew what was good for it. Bernardo. Nobody knew where the name had come from or where Bernardo himself had come from. For that matter, he was just always there. And for a long time he was invisible, or as invisible as dogs are when they survive as best they can, behind buildings and in small corners, always looking for something to feed the animal inside them. His was a feral existence, chasing rabbits in fields when he couldn't find anything in town, a dog with a dog's limitations, but finding a way, slower than so many other animals built to be faster than dogs, with long legs and fast wings, so that all was left to the dog Bernardo was to think his way into the next day, to be smart if he could not be fast, to be strong when he felt weakest in a long chase, and to be kind of heart when he least felt it, having been struck on the ears by a stranger. Bernardo at first had no story, but through the years he became part of everyone else's story, and in that way he was always bigger than he was. He himself, in truth, the real Bernardo, was small and regular. He had an appetite for chicken and a fondness for warmth. He gravitated toward people who gravitated toward him, and that made a good life. Miguel Torres, his keeper these recent years, made sure of that. A good life was what they gave each other, and Bernardo was happy. When he awoke, Bernardo's first impulse was to jump up and run at all costs, which was a lesson the rabbits had taught him. Run! No matter what, and no matter where, and right now. But as he tried to lift himself and find his bearings to make his big push away, his legs failed him. His legs, his rockets, they had never failed him before. His snout sailed forward and his neck, but nothing else followed. His shoulders tried, but they were helped more by the deep breath he took into his lungs than from their own strength. His shoulders, instead, felt to him as if he had nothing attached to them, nothing but weights, as if whatever beyond them was something he was stuck in. But it was also that he could not see, not to look at himself. He had on a big something, some kind of paper all around his head, something big or bigger, as if he were suddenly a huge sunflower. He moved his head back and forth, but Dr. Bartholomew shushed him. Bernardo did not know what was happening, but he knew better than to do something nobody wanted him to do. He had learned this much at least over the last years. Do what you are told and then get away as fast as you can where nothing can hurt you. Bernardo would play along, at least for now. He looked at the window, but it was closed. He looked at the door, but it was closed too. The doctor was reassuring him, but having everything closed was not a comfort. He would play along, all right, because he had no choice. Besides, moving would have been some work, and his body hurt. Staying still, even if it was not what he wanted, was the better choice. It suited him. After a few minutes, the doctor picked Bernardo up and carried him out the door. Bernardo saw a room full of children, and they all laughed at him. Laughter was always a better sound than so many other noises. It made him want to laugh as well. He tried to throw a little bark into the mix, but not much sound came out of him. Dr. Bartholomew spoke Miguel Torres' name, and Bernardo recognized it. Miguel Torres! That's where he needed to go, home. Where was Miguel Torres? He had to get to their house. Bernardo knew that Miguel Torres would be worrying about him. It was time for him to be home. But again, his legs did not move the way legs are supposed to move. Bernardo bided his time, and Dr. Bartholomew put him down gently onto a couch. Bernardo wasn't sure he was supposed to be on the couch, so he kept quiet. The recovery was slow but even. A curious thing had happened during that night, however, and everyone wanted to know how Bernardo was. Children kept coming back to check on him, and chickens found their way in all manner of cooked fashion to their door. Dr. Bartholomew explained it, asking Miguel Torres a few weeks later to stop by and to bring Bernardo with him, ostensibly for a checkup, but really so that the day Bernardo was hit by the car might be reenacted. They would not talk about the accident, of course, not at all. This was about the cure and everything that followed. Showing how the children carried Bernardo, that he was injured and therefore reclined on his back for comfort, and that the children carrying him were blocked from view by the car that was between them and Senora Belmares, this was easy enough to demonstrate to everyone, including Senora Belmares herself, who sniffed her nose and said, of course, that is how it happened. But the event took on its own life. Accurate or not, Bernardo on his flying carpet around town was the real story, with science only a nagging backseat driver. It was not long before people made piñatas of Bernardo on his carpet, that schoolchildren doodled that image in the marginalia of their notebooks, and the singers in the establishment on the north side of town, which everybody knew but never called by name, composed the Corrido del Bernardo, which attempted something of an obscene rhyme with Belmares, a moment that everyone, or rather almost everyone, thought was the funniest rhyme on earth. Where people would have to go to hear the song, but part of town sang it out loud was another story altogether. A story and a quick wink. And Bernardo, the dog with the elegant name, Bernardo himself for the rest of his days ate what he liked, walked where he wanted, and dug holes whenever he felt the urge. That's all the time we have for the great outdoors just now. I'm Mark Deutsch for the Virginia Voice. This program is on the air every Saturday morning at 8:30, with a rebroadcast on Thursday mornings at 7. And you can listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.